This is an ABC podcast.
Mandy McCracken's family seriously love Halloween. A few years ago, Mandy, her husband and their kids dressed up as flesh-eating zombies and went prowling around the neighbourhood. Mandy, who was all dressed up like a zombie bride with blood dripping down her gown, was easily the most impressive. No one was going to beat her that Halloween because Mandy has no forearms. They were lost to sepsis in 2013, along with her lower legs. And although she looked pretty wild as the zombie bride, it's likely the local kids mostly took it in their stride because Mandy's been really upfront at communicating what happened to her and in getting the community past any weirdness they might have about it. It's one of the reasons she said she loved being a zombie bride so much, because it allowed her to embrace her amputations in a completely unexpected way. Mandy is the co-founder of an online support group called the Quad Squad for people in similar situations to hers. It's been a long, slow recovery, but now Mandy uses prosthetics to walk, to drive a car, to do the usual stuff around the house. And her next step? Well, Mandy's pretty keen to take up her old hobby of rock climbing. Hi, Mandy.
Hello, Richard. Hello.
When I interviewed the great Jill Hicks some years ago, the first thing I asked her was if she had any nicknames for her prosthetic legs. Do you do that?
Yeah. I named my Alana and Alan after the prosthetist and the technician that actually built them for me. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
And then my legs are standing and kneeling. They're cousins.
Standing and kneeling. Lovely.
Standing, kneeling, yes.
Do you like to give names to things like that?
Yeah. That all actually started when I was in my ICU ward, just trying to work out how the hell to deal with this situation. And I actually, the very first thing I named was my bed. I named it Elvis because it had wheels. So I've always really come up with just how to make light of a situation, and naming things is the easy way to go.
Does it feel really good to slip out of the legs at the end of the day?
Yeah, they're heavy and they're bulky and sometimes they're not very comfortable. So yeah, it's like taking off a pair of high heels, and it's great to just put them in the corner of the room and be a la naturel.
What kind of hands do you have? Is there robot tech on them of any kind?
Yep. So the hands I've got are called myoelectric hands, and so they're robotic and they open and close. They've got electrodes on the inside of them that sit on my skin, and there's a motor in the hand somewhere, and you actually plug them in at night like you do plug in a mobile phone and let them charge up. So they open and close, and they're not the flashiest on the market because those ones are almost worth the price of my house. So these ones are what the Australian government very kindly afford for me, and I'm incredibly grateful for them. Yeah, they make a huge difference.
How do you operate them then? Can you do that by twitching your arm in a certain way?
So you use the muscles in your arm that flex your wrist backwards and forwards. So if you're flexing your wrist one way and then the other, that's the same movement that I do. And a big push with your muscle does a really quick open of your hand. And then if you want to just do a very slight little open, you just sort of twitch your muscle so that it just opens by, you know, a centimetre at a time.
And can you do that without thinking now? Is that like second nature to you now?
Oh, definitely. Yep. If you wanted me to tie my shoes, I'd be able to do it without really?
Having
to tie. Well, I mean, you know, on a good day, I can tie my shoelaces, but
see, I struggle sometimes.
Yeah, it's a bit of a physical challenge, but if I was in a real push, it might take me about 15, 20 minutes to tie a shoe, but I reckon I could do it.
I've seen a photo on a disability website of one of your prosthetic arms, Mandy, and it's all by itself pulling a tractor gear stick. How on earth did that naughty arm manage to get away from you like that, I wonder?
Well, my husband and I, we were sitting watching TV one night when we were on a family holiday, and my sister sent me a message saying, you know, where are the photos of the family holiday? And it was 9:30 at night. So my husband pulled my arm off and shoved it in the fridge holding onto a beer, and he took a photo and sent it back to my sister. And then the magic of Alana and Alan were born, and we used to regularly pull my body parts off and put them in odd situations and take photos of them and put them up on social media, and it made it fun.
So much of your story is about managing expectations about life. You grew up in a large Catholic family in suburban Melbourne. Did you have any fixed plans back then for what you wanted in life?
I'd watched my mum be a stay-at-home mum and dad went off to work, and we were the incredibly comfortable nuclear family. And as a kid growing up, that was so comforting, just to have a parent that was always there. You know, you woke up one day and you had a sore tummy and didn't want to go to school, or you came home after school and there was just someone there to greet you at the door. And I sort of said to myself that I'd like to do that for my own kids. So I did the big career in my 20s, getting big pay packets and doing the corporate thing. And I'd done that, and I was really looking forward to just being home with the kids. So that was sort of my plan, was just to quietly get my kids through school and maybe get back to a part-time job and just to live a pretty simple life, yeah.
Your husband, Rod, is your partner in crime with these kind of stunts I was mentioning earlier. Mm-hmm. How did you meet him?
Well, I was working for a publishing company at the time, and I was a sales rep, and my job was to go to bookshops and basically sell them lots of books. And I turned up to this bookshop one day and there was this gorgeous fellow behind the counter, and instantly we just connected. And he was in the store. He had the radio blaring. There was this huge amount of music, and I walked into the store and immediately sold him, I think it was like something like $15,000 worth of books, which back then was just the most ridiculous amount of books for the company that I was working for. Needless to say, three quarters of those books came back to us because they never sold. But yeah, we were pretty much engaged within 3 months. We knew that this was going to happen. We hit it off instantly, and 22 years later, we're still married.
You did a bit of rock climbing together, you and your husband, Rod. What was it you loved about rock climbing? Is it the climb or is it the view from the top?
Rock climbing is a challenge purely against yourself. There's nobody else there except you on the wall. Yes, okay, you've got somebody holding you up with a rope, making sure you don't go splat. But if you get halfway up and you start getting rattled, which I used to always do because I've got a fear of heights, it's this mental conversation that you have with yourself as to whether or not you're going to give up and go down the wall, or if you're going to just try that one extra hold above your head and just push yourself a little bit further. And yeah, it was the only time that I'd actually sort of really pushed myself beyond what was comfortable. And yeah, to this day, I think that frame of mind's really actually got me a long way.
I can freak out over heights. Does it help you conquer that fear, or is that something you just have to confront every single time?
Every time. Every time I climbed, there was a fear of heights. You get to the top and all of a sudden you look down and you're like, oh, holy moly, I'm so far from the ground. And you are completely reliant on the person below you to keep you alive. Like if things went wrong and they, for some reason, slipped, you know, it doesn't take much to drop you from three stories up. So, yeah, it's quite terrifying.
So the really good feeling then comes not so much at the top but at the bottom when you're back down again and you've done it then.
Oh, yeah, and you stand there and you look at it and you're like, wow, I did it. And each climb's got a level, a difficulty level. So, you know, you might stand there and you say you just conquered a number 17 climb, and the climb right next to you might be a number 19, and you're like, okay, well, let's see if I can do that one. And every time you're going one step up, you know, it's tiny little increments, but it's always that I've conquered the 17, and you know, next week I'll come back and I'll try the 18 or the 19.
So after you two got married, you relocated about an hour up the Hume Highway from Melbourne to the town of Kilmore. Were you ready for that change? Did you want that country town change?
Yeah, Rod and I, we love living in central Melbourne. We did the 20-year-old life. We were really enjoying the pubs and community and having all our mates around us. But I, as I said, I'd done a lot of corporate life, and the corporate world I was living in at the time was pretty hard and fast. You know, there were budgets he had to meet, and if you'd met it, they doubled it, and if you met that, they doubled it again. And it was emotionally exhausting, and I was just ready for a major change. And so, yeah, Rod applied for all these secondary colleges after he'd finished his teaching degree, and we just applied around Victoria to any secondary college we could think of, and sure enough, Kilmore came up, and we went for a drive one day up the Hume, and we got to the town and went, well, it looks as good as any. Yeah, sure, let's give it a go. And within a few weeks, left behind the city life for life up in country, and we had no idea what it was going to be like. And the first nights in the country were almost terrifying for me. I'd grown up in the city, you know, the sound of trams rattling past and that noise of your neighbours. And we moved from Paran, where you would lie in bed in the middle of the night and you could actually hear your neighbour snoring. And, you know, moving up into the country, we were surrounded by paddocks and there was no noise. And it was so different and pretty daunting, just that quiet. But now, of course, I'm used to it and I absolutely adore it. It's great.
And how did you take to social life living in the country?
Setting yourself up socially in the country was a challenge. I was pregnant by the time we moved up. I was desperate to meet people up here. And I wasn't working, maternity leave ready to go. And I actually sort of started trawling the streets trying to find people. And I ended up joining a craft group, which were women over there in their mid-70s, and they were all talking about their husband's hemorrhoids and whether or not they were going to buy a caravan and drive off into the sunset, and it wasn't quite my thing. But, of course, pop out a baby and you join a mother's group, and I literally pushed my way in the door because it was meant to be a group of eight and I made it nine. And I said to the maternal health nurse, please, I've got to come. I've just got to get out the door. And met this fantastic group of women who were all living pretty much exactly the same life as I was. And that was the start of my community connection up here.
So you had that life you were hoping to have, you know, lovely family, lovely husband, living in a nice part of the world, good community, all that sort of thing. You actually did have that thing. Did you have that feeling that you'd arrived at what you wanted in life at that point?
Yeah, I was as happy as pig in mud. I was becoming really connected to the community. I was on a whole heap of committees. I knew half the town. If I didn't know them, Rod was teaching them. We would go to the supermarket and literally bump into the neighbourhood. And you could go to the supermarket and be there for an hour and just buy milk and bread. So, yeah, it was a beautiful change of pace for us as a couple. And, yeah, we were really enjoying it. It was great.
And one day in 2013, you became unwell. How did you become unwell? What do you remember of it coming on?
So on the Wednesday, I was due to go and meet my sister-in-law and catch up with her and her eldest, and sent the kids off to school. And I came home and I just went, oh, I feel pretty rotten. I'm going to climb back into bed. So I cancelled my day out and climbed into bed. And I didn't really surface for a couple of days. And I had sort of flu, gastro-y kind of thing going on, vomiting, a bit of diarrhea, just felt rotten. And by Friday night, my temperature was just sky high and I began passing out was the key, actually. And I didn't really tell Rod. It was like, oh, you know, this will be all right. You know, he was busy keeping the kids under control. And I climbed back into bed and then I had a bucket by my bed, as you do when you got gastro, and I threw up in it again, and I thought, no, I've got to turn the light on and just have a look what's going on. And I looked at the bucket, and it looked like I'd thrown up coffee granules. Everything was black, and it was grainy, and it was just, oh, and all of a sudden I've just gone to myself, nah, this is full on, this is not pretty. Time to call an ambulance.
Coughing up things that looked like coffee granules, what was it?
It was dried blood. Yeah, I was vomiting dried blood. So we got myself packed into an ambulance and we very quickly sort of got down on the freeway and heading towards the bigger hospitals in the city. And halfway down the freeway, I actually got stopped. The ambulance pulled over at the petrol station on the Hume. And the beautiful young fellow in the ambulance said, oh, we're just going to change you over to a different ambulance. And sure enough, there was a MICA ambulance, a medical intensive care ambulance, sitting there waiting for us. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning. The sun was barely coming over the horizon. And they pulled me out of this ambulance and shoved me in a different one. And then it was on for young and old. The sirens were on and I was heading very quickly down to the big hospital.
Did you think you were dying?
No, I didn't have a clue that I was dying. I had no idea that I was that sick because I am incredibly optimistic, which to my detriment, I think, at that time.
So what happened when you got to the hospital in Melbourne then, Mandy?
So I got to the hospital and it was really interesting, actually. The nursing staff were really buzzing around me, asking me 1,001 questions. And my fingers were tingling. Like, I had pins and needles in my fingers. And I'd had pins and needles in my fingers before because I was getting carpal tunnel going on. And that's what it felt like. And I kept sort of flexing my fingers going, you know, this feels weird. And I mentioned it to the nursing staff and they sort of went, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. And all of a sudden they rushed me into intensive care and the curtains were pulled around me and I was surrounded by probably about 10 nursing staff and they were screaming orders at each other. And there was me in the middle of it just going, oh God, what's going on? What's going on? And my last memory was of this male doctor and female doctor standing next to them and they were trying to get a vein in me and instantly everything went black. And that was my last recollection before this happened.
Had they put you in a coma at that point?
They put me in a coma and I went to a different world. It was the most surreal experience. I was not part of planet Earth. I was all of a sudden in this world that had two dimensions. It was like being on a chessboard and I felt completely trapped on this chessboard that went on forever and I couldn't move and I knew that I had to get out of it and I was just completely consumed in this other dimension. Oh, it almost felt like time completely stood still. And then my hallucinations would change and I would instantly be in a cave underground and I was stuck in this muddy space and I couldn't breathe and I was really conscious of a tube in my throat trying desperately to suck air through this tube and I was desperate to get out and then it immediately flashed into another situation that I was in an all-female circus.
Wow.
Yeah, I was blissfully happy. So it went from terrifying to blissfully peaceful. Timeless, floating, there was a nothingness to it. And then, sure enough, I woke up and it turned out to be 10 days later.
What do you remember of coming out of the coma and what you saw?
My memory was pretty all over the place of it because, obviously, I was on a lot of medication. I was in a hospital bed in an ICU department and my hands and feet were wrapped up in plastic bracing to try and stop them from curling up. And my feet were black and my arm especially looked like it had been dipped in black paint, absolutely black, like something you would see in an Egyptian mummy film.
I can't imagine the terror of that. Was it terrifying?
No. No, it wasn't because I was really aware of what had happened. Like I woke up and I knew that I had survived something, like I was alive.
Do you think the coma psychologically prepared you for what you were about to see when you woke up then?
It was probably the calm before the storm, honestly. Yeah, possibly it did. Maybe looking at it now, that's probably what it did. It was a bit of peace and quiet whilst all this horrificness was going on around me. The unfortunate part was, of course, Rod and my three daughters had to see me go through that. And, you know, I think for them, those 10 days would have been possibly the worst 10 days they could have lived through.
So this was a strep A infection you had, and you had sepsis from it. Your ruined arms and legs, could you feel them or operate them in any way?
My hands and feet had no movement. I had no movement. The only thing I could move was my face and my head from side to side. I have no idea why I lost all control and strength in my body.
Was there any pain in them?
I had moments of severe pain, yes. But I could actually feel my fingers. And to this day, I can still wiggle my fingers and toes. Like they're you know, the nerves of them are still there, like I can still feel them. But at the time, I felt like I'd been cast in concrete, like it was so heavy, my whole body felt completely unable to move at all.
Did you feel dissociated from them in some sort of weird way? Like, did you think that they're not quite mine anymore? I know that's an odd thing to ask, but maybe you didn't feel that way at all, but did that thought occur to you?
I don't think so. No, I don't. The way I view my hands and feet now is, like, even my prosthetic limbs are now mine. So it's been a real change of thought process as to what belongs to me these days and what doesn't. So, yeah, I'm not really sure how I felt about my hands and feet back then. But I knew I was incredibly lucky to wake up. Like, this was a real second chance that I was given.
Did your kids understand what was happening to you at the time when you were going through this?
Yeah, so unfortunately my girls had to come in and say goodbye to me on the first day that I was in ICU. I'd been put into my coma. They all thought that I was not going to survive. And I say it's unfortunate because you never want to have your children go through that. But after that fact, that date, Rod kept them up to date with what was happening. And I think the beauty of it was, you know, today mum's dealing with this. Today mum's dealing with that. You know, today we're doing this step and that step. And so it slowly, step by step, brought them out of that they were going to lose their mum and that things were just going to change.
Somehow, Mandy, amazingly, it was at this time or thereabouts that you were taken outside into a courtyard, into the fresh air. How did that happen?
So by that stage, I'd been in ICU for probably about 4 weeks, and I was connected to every single machine I think the hospital owned. I was surrounded by machines that went ping. And my view was the nurse's station. That's all I could see. And one of the nursing staff, and I'm sure her name was Helen, said to me one day, she came bouncing in the door with this great big smile, and she's like, come on, Mandy, we're going to take you out to the courtyard. And by that stage, the whole concept of doing something like that was just terrifying because I was so mentally exhausted and fragile, and just the concept of just being taken out of this comfort zone that I'd established myself in my day-to-day life in the ICU. So Helen probably spent about 2 hours disconnecting me from all the machines that I was connected to and putting me onto portable devices. And she pushed me down the corridor with another nurse and took my entire hospital bed out into the corridor and into the courtyard in the hospital. And she parked me underneath a little tree. And it was the most beautiful Melbourne winter's day. The sky was as blue as can be and the birds were out. And Helen just sat behind me on a park bench and she didn't talk to me. And she just gave me a moment to just be there. And that was when I actually had a really hard conversation with myself, because I knew that I was so sick. I knew that if I really wanted to, that I could just give this up and just let Mother Nature do its thing. And then this little finch bounced past on the tree and it sort of stopped and you could almost say that it stopped to say hello to me, and it was just me and this bird. And I said to myself, you know, don't be ridiculous. You've survived this and you should be grateful and you've got a second chance. And I said to myself, okay, well, let's make this my strength. Let's make this what's going to make me, you know, let's laugh through this situation and let's find the humor in this and let's be strong and make this the best situation. That's where I came up with the ideas. Okay, well, let's name everything. And I named my tracheotomy Trevor and my bed Elvis, and I thought that I was going to laugh through this, and it was a real chance for me to change my frame of mind. And, you know, that was really the turning point for me that kept me going.
just for that moment when you were there under the tree, under the sunshine, and you could see the bird. Was life really sweet just for a moment? Really sweet in that moment?
Yeah, life was very sweet. I survived.
Have you seen that nurse, Helen, since that day?
I've not seen Helen since that day, and I'd love to see Helen. I'd love to say thank you to her. She probably made me value life so much.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Mandy, you were telling me how a very kind nurse wheeled your bed into a courtyard, and that was when you resolved to survive all the radical surgery that lay ahead. Where did all that start?
So they amputated my arms within a couple of weeks after I woke up from my coma, and because it was very obvious where my hands started and stopped, literally, as I said, dipped in black paint. And with my legs, unfortunately, I had dry gangrene going in patches all up my legs, and they had to work out where the good stuff started and the bad stuff stopped. So they actually did hyperbaric treatment for a few weeks to absolutely overload me with oxygen and try and improve the good skin. So, yeah, it wasn't for a couple of weeks later that I got my legs done.
Was that all about saving the knees, that process?
Yeah, knees are king when it comes to prosthetic legs. So if you've got your knees, just being able to walk is a complete game changer. So, yes, it did save my knees. It took a while for my knees to heal and come back to life, but, I've still got them.
So there you were in hospital. Tell me how a man named Matthew Ames came into your life around about that time.
So I was lying in hospital, and I think I'd only just had my legs amputated. And one of my young plastic surgeons came running in, and she said to me, "There's a fellow on telly tomorrow night, and he looks like he's just had exactly the same as you happen." And so sure enough, there's Matthew Ames, and he had the same bacterial infection as me. He had sepsis like me. He had his amputations like me. And it was his wife and his four kids that were watching him go through this. So it was exactly the same story as us. And so sure enough, I watched it and my family watched it. And I think my whole community back in Kilmore watched it. And we saw him smiling and laughing, and he was living life. He was just cracking on. And it was so refreshing to see. It was light at the end of the tunnel for us all.
Who got in touch with him then?
My sister rang him the next night and said, "You know, my little sister's lying in hospital, and it'd be really great if she could speak to you." And I think actually for my sister, it was a chance for her to just hear that this was all going to be okay, and that, you know, her little sister was going to be fine, which is exactly what Matthew said.
Did Matthew Ames come to visit you then in hospital, Mandy?
Yeah, so Matthew was actually getting surgery in Melbourne, and he and his wife, Di, and their daughter, Emily, flew down, and they came to visit. And sure enough, they rolled in the door on his electric wheelchair with Emily sitting on the end. And it was just the most amazing visit, because these people had lived exactly what we were living. And they were bright and happy and great fun. And they knew the same story as what we've been going through.
So that looked like a possible future for you then?
Matthew and I had lived this. They'd come out of it. They'd gone home. They were re-establishing their life. So Matthew was my future. He was, and he knew. He knew exactly what the next few months would look like, and he knew what the next year or so looked like to be back home with your family.
And did that feel like something you should pass on yourself to other people in similar situations?
Well, yeah. Matthew and I, a few months later, we all caught up at a family holiday, and we had the kids there, and he brought along another quadruple amputee, Corinne Barrett. And all of a sudden, there's three multiple limb amputees sitting at a table, surrounded by our family, surrounded by our kids. We were all pulling off body parts. We were all laughing at the most ridiculous situations that we keep finding ourselves in. And it was just this desperately perfect, perfectly comfortable situation that we were in. And it was just so refreshing and exhilarating. And when we had to leave, we were all of us, the whole maybe 10, 12 of us sat there and said, we've got to stay in touch. We've got to make sure we keep in touch. And so the Quad Squad was born.
The way you're talking about it, it sounds like you sort of realized you're all part of this very, very interesting club that you've got to go through hell to get into, in a way. It's kind of like quite a small but very emotionally powerful club. Is that right?
Yeah. We have a very uncomfortable initiation process, but once you are a part of our team, you are never leaving. We've got you forever. What began was just us on social media staying in touch. And then every time someone else heard of another multiple limb amputee in hospital, we would get a phone call or a message from the nurse or from the wife or, you know, from someone who knew these people, and they would connect us up. And then we would speak to these people, and it was, again, refreshing for them to be able to discuss stuff that nobody understood, even the nursing stuff, you know. They have no idea what this feels like. And it got to the point that we were offering suggestions on which surgeons to talk to and treatment options so that, again, other amputees could keep their knees. And this world was created, and it's now we're up to, I believe, 240-odd multiple limb amputees around the world that were all in touch with each other.
First, you have to get through rehab, don't you? What was that like for you, being in rehab with other amputees who may have lost limbs for all kinds of different reasons?
The rehab hospital that I went to, the majority of the people are in their late 60s, early 70s. Most of them have lost a single leg through diabetes. And the atmosphere was very frustrating. A lot of people there were quite content to go and do physio for an hour a day and then go and lie back in their bed and watch TV. And for me, at the time, I was 39 years old and I had this family at home. And all I wanted to do was get home. So I would push my physio and ask for, you know, three sessions of physio a day, four sessions a day. Can you please push me? I want to get out of here. And, yeah, I found it really hard work mentally to keep going.
Did you meet anyone doing rehab who was quite wonderful?
Yeah, there was this one fellow in rehab. His name was Cecil. And I remember Cecil on his first day in rehab. I was lying in bed waiting for the breakfast to arrive with literally no body parts on, and I couldn't get out of bed unless somebody helped me. And sure enough, this voice came down the corridor, and it was this fellow in a wheelchair with a single leg missing. And he rolled into my room completely unannounced, uninvited, and he turned up at the end of my bed and he's gone, "G'day, how are you going? Oh, my name's Cecil." And he had a voice that sounded like a cockatoo, and he was this bright, cheery little fellow. And I reckon he looked like a little Australian leprechaun. And it turned out that he was a farmer from just over the border in New South Wales. And he had a tractor accident, and the tractor had rolled on his leg. And he was this bright spark that used to go down the corridor and wake everybody up in the morning. And he'd tell all these 65, 75-year-olds to get out of bed. "Come on, get out of bed. It's time to get going. Off you get." And there he was, bright, dressed, ready to go for the day. And he was just gorgeous. And he was so beautiful with his motivation that he was giving everyone. It was great. And he used to always have his hat on that made him look just like a little leprechaun. And I think he even had on his one leg, he would have had a pair of sandals with his socks pulled up to his knee and his shorts. It was just gorgeous. And sure enough, he kept in touch. Like, I'm still in touch with Cecil and his wife, Rosie.
So what was your state of mind like when you came home to Kilmore from hospital?
My state of mind was very messy. I was very torn up. It was really challenging. I'd gone from being the boss of my household to being a guest in my household. And the kitchen. My side of the bench was in the kitchen, and where everything was my doing. And then when I came home, Rod was there, and I was parked on the guest side of the kitchen bench. And sure enough, Rod had changed stuff. The salt and pepper shakers were in the wrong place, and the house worked differently. And I sat there, and it was like, no, you've got it wrong. This is not right. And still to this day, I correct him, which is a bit of a sore point in this household, but we won't go there.
I'm conscious of the fact that you live in the country, which is dirt roads, gravel pathways, every surface in the country just about is bumpy and uneven. And is that a bastard of a thing when you're trying to learn to walk on prosthetic legs?
Absolutely. Learning to walk on prosthetic legs, you want a flat surface that is even, that you don't have to look at every time you take a step, because the art of walking with prosthetic legs is standing tall. So we ended up going to Coles. My physio said to me, you know, where can you go that is a flat, even surface that you can walk for 20 minutes? And the only place was the local supermarket. So I would go with Rod, and I'd hold on to the trolley to keep me upright, and we would walk up and down the aisle. And that was my rehab.
Have you learned to manage those moments of frustration, terrible, sort of terrible, hideous frustration?
When I first came home, I would have tantrums. I tantrumed like I was 4 years old. And I remember one day I was desperately trying to put something away. I was trying to put the kids' clothes away just so that I could claim that I was useful in the household. And my prosthetic hands just weren't working. I couldn't get them to open, to grab the drawer handle, to pull it open. And I ended up just kicking, literally kicking and screaming and flapping about until my prosthetic limbs flew out across the room. And the kids actually came screaming in the door, "Mom, you're all right, you're all right." And I was just there, just screaming in tears because I was so over it. But what I've learnt now is you take a deep breath. When you get to that point, you stop, you breathe, and you leave the situation. Go and walk to the letterbox and stand at the top of the driveway and just take that moment or two to calm down, and then go back and try again. And somewhere I read, they said, if you give up on the 99th time, you're never going to know that the 100th go is when it actually works. So now I know that there's a real beauty and motivation in allowing yourself to try and try and try and fail and fail, and that space that is required before you can go back and give it another go.
Your kids were going to school. Other kids in the school would have been possibly weirded out by the fact that your daughters had a mum living with what she was living with. Did you become aware of that? And how would you have dealt with that?
When I first came home, I came home without legs on because I was still waiting for my knees to heal, and I had these weird prosthetic arms. And, yeah, we dropped the kids off at school and picked them up, and Rod would wheel me around to meet them at the school gate in my wheelchair. And the local kids were freaked out by me. Like, I was a sight. Like, I was covered in bandages. My hair had all fallen out. I looked horrific. And quite, you know, you would expect a little kid to freak out with that because it's scary. Somebody that looks scary. And I remember turning up, and my middle daughter, Isabel, one day came home and she burst into tears and she said, "Mum, all the kids are calling you like you're a robot or a pirate because you've got, you know, robot arms and pirate prosthetics." And she was just beside herself. So I rang up the teacher immediately and I said, "I want to come in for show and tell tomorrow, and we're going to get the whole group of, I think it was, she was in prep or grade one at the time, we're going to get the whole group of kids to sit down and they can ask me anything." And so sure enough, the next day, Isabel stood next to me and she pulled my body parts off and she passed them around the room and she explained how everything worked. And I went from being the local freak to being something that was quite amazing. Like the kids were like, oh, wow, your hands are like Darth Vader's hands and, you know, your legs are like pirate legs. And literally these kids are holding my legs as they go around the room. And this one kid stood up and he goes, I've got the same scar as you. You know, it goes from down my tummy. And he pulled his shirt up and there's this great big almighty scar down the middle. And Isabel's immediately gone to pull my shirt up and go, yeah, Mum's is exactly the same. And so from
steady on, daughter.
From then on, the kids saw me as just another mum and they were fascinated. And now the kids bounce around and you know, they were really interested and excited to see me come home with different prosthetics and different technology. And yeah, I've done a lot of show and tells with schools now.
The late, great Stella Young, the brilliant disability advocate, used to talk quite a bit about how much she hated either being pitiful or inspirational. It was either one or the other a lot of the time. How do you feel about all that?
I loved Stella Young. I only discovered her after this happened to me and that speech that she said and said that we are not your inspiration was just perfect for me to hear. Yeah, don't congratulate me for getting out of bed. I don't need that. You know, congratulate me for doing something special that anybody else could do because people living with disability are just doing their day-to-day lives and we need something to strive for and we need to be celebrated when we do strive for above and beyond. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the able-bodied world expectations are pretty low for somebody like me. So, yeah.
I think so much damage has been done over the years, for decades, for however long, by able-bodied people who have wanted to sort of put disabled people out of sight. To sequester them because they make them feel uncomfortable and it's done in the name of compassion. Do you have to help people through their feelings of weirdness when you meet them by being kind of aggressively normal around them?
I love it when I have tradespeople turn up on my doorstep because I open up the door, they're coming in to fix the roof in my house and there I am sitting there with one leg on and no arms and no in my wheelchair. And it's quite a sport because they all just go, and their facial expressions immediately start looking away. And I find it, I almost challenge them, like it's, come on, look at me, see me, I want you to see me and I want you to see me and still have that same conversation. So I tend to just crack on. Yep, come fix my roof. I'll show you where it is. Follow me. Here we go. And I make no mention of the fact that, you know, don't excuse me for having my body parts sitting on the kitchen bench. This is my world and I have make no excuse for it. But the one situation that I do have to allow people a bit of time to understand is when they offer their hand to shake it. So if I've got my prosthetic hands on, they look so natural that when they put their hand out to shake it and they can feel my plastic hand, they do get a shock. They're like, oh, my God, like this. And you know, it's that instant that they didn't expect it. And I've now learnt that if I say to them, oh, yes, I've got prosthetic hands, don't mind me, then it gives them the headspace to be able to understand it and go, oh, okay. And then I very quickly explain it. Yep, prosthetic hands. I've got prosthetic feet too. Ha ha. And then we all move on. So I found that if I do that, it lightens the situation and makes them more comfortable because yeah, we don't want to make people too uncomfortable every time we meet them.
Paralympians are pretty amazing people. I mean, they're hardcore. Quite often they look amazing. They do all these extraordinary things. But I wonder if there needs to be more space for people who aren't Paralympians, who are in situations like yours.
I found the Paralympian thing really quite uncomfortable when I first came out of hospital because the only images that I could see of people with disabilities were incredibly fit, 20-somethings, striding along the beach with these incredible running blades. And that wasn't me. It's not me. And I couldn't relate to it. And I found it actually made me really angry. And I've been battling with the whole Paralympian conversation in my head. Why is it that we only see Paralympians? Why can't we see everybody else? Certainly in these Paralympics, the conversation has been, let's see everybody else. You know, so many of the athletes are saying, it's great that we're here, it's great that we can be celebrated, but where's everybody else? And I think we really need to start having more people on our screens that aren't Paralympians. You know, where are the disabled journalists? Where are the disabled artists, musicians? You know, the regular people that live with disability. It's great that the Paralympians begin that conversation, but I think it's really now time that we extend that extent of exposure to the rest of our community.
Having said all that, is rock climbing in your future, and can it be?
Yeah, why not? I used to rock climb, and I found this fellow on social media called the No-Handed Bandit, and he lost his hands when he was in his 20s to an electrical accident, and sure enough, he's rock climbing, and he has exactly the same arms as me. So he was actually just using body-powered hooks to get up the wall, and I actually went to my prosthetist and said, can you make me some arms? And she said, oh, I don't know. And I found myself at a conference a few days later in front of a room of prosthetists, people that build body parts. And I said to them, come on, guys, who's going to build me some arms to get me up a wall? And again, they all went, oh, I don't know. And I just went, bugger it. Okay. So my prosthetist built me some multi-purpose arms that can click things like kitchen knives on, or a whisk, or a gardening trail. And it turned out that I could actually put my hooks on it, and they hold my body weight. So why not? Let's give it a go. There's adaptive rock climbing groups out there that do these things and help people like me get up a wall. And it would be really great to be able to just give it a go.
That must have to be really properly harnessed to the entirety of your body, I suppose, just about, in order to be stable enough for you to do that.
No, these ones have like a rubber sleeve that slide in over your arms. It's a silicon sleeve, and it has a pin that sticks out at the end, and it clicks into a socket. So it's actually only connected up to sort of bit beyond my elbows. So it probably would be the most natural way of to feel that rock climbing sensation again. But I've got to be very careful that I don't slip and leave them up the wall and I fall off and somebody has to get my arm that's stuck up the wall for me.
So you've been doing public speaking for years now, doing media interviews like this one. In the process of telling your story, did you find out things you didn't know before, just in the act of telling your story?
Rod and I have been telling this story together since when I first came home. It started at the little primary school, and it's now gone. We've done lots of schools and community groups, and we always do it together because it's not just my story, it's his as well. And we have spent plenty of times in front of an audience of 200 people workshopping what we've been through. He will tell his version, and I'll tell my version, and it won't be until we get in the car afterwards and we're like, oh, really, is that how you felt? So, yeah, we've done a lot of it hard on the sleeve, tears streaming down our faces in front of a crowd of strangers, which has been very cathartic. It's been great.
Tell me about the ABC Storytelling Scholarship. What are you working on for that?
One thing I think a lot of people don't know is what disability looks like on a daily basis. What does it look like in the morning when you wake up, and what does it look like throughout the day, and what does it look like when you're lying in bed at night and there's nobody there except yourself? And I think that needs to be told. You know, we have so much of that on an able-bodied world, but we never have it from a disability perspective. You know, what is life really like when you're disabled? And a lot of this came because my daughter has moved schools, and in doing so, we decided as a family that her and I would live in Melbourne Monday to Friday while she went to school, which of course means that I need to set myself up in a house as a single parent and get the support around me to live that life, which was really scary. Like the whole idea of that is terrifying. You know, what happens at 2 o'clock in the morning when I need to get out of bed in a hurry and my legs are leaning against the wall? And in talking to my friends in the quad squad, they all said, you know, we can't see ourselves doing that. Like, how could you possibly do that? And so one of them said to me, well, you've got to write it down. You've got to let us know how you go, because we want to know that you can live on your own as a quadruple amputee. You know, we've got children in our group who are 8 years old, 15 years old, and they want to know that there's a life out there and that they can live as an independent adult. So that's what I'm doing. I'm telling my version of what that looks like.
You know, if I had to sort of tell the story of your life in a couple of sentences, one way I could tell it would be to say, Mandy McCracken always wanted to have a nice family life with lots of love and laughter with a husband and kids. And stuff happened along the way, but she's pretty much got that. That'd be it, wouldn't it? It's kind of worked, has worked out like you hoped it would, more or less, hasn't it? Or not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm living a great life. I'm in a fabulous relationship with a great family, brilliant kids, and the world is my oyster. I just happen to have no hands and feet. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to what my future brings. I've got no idea what it looks like, and I have learned that it can change in an instant, and whatever that is going to look like is going to be perfectly fine. I'm quite excited about what the future holds for me, and I would like to challenge the world to see what comes next.
Great to speak with you, Mandy. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
You're welcome, Richard.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. Find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Mandy McCracken's the co-founder of an online support group for people who've been through multiple amputations. It's called the Quad Squad. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.